Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I am Michael Footer.
Each episode, we'll cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
I'm not going to be surprised today. We actually have someone today who is an industry pro. I'm not surprised by it.
Okay, that's cool. That's fair.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Yeah, we've been doing this now for 7 episodes, even though this is episode 6. Remember, we had the 0th episode.
Episode. Yes. Okay. We're doing things a little bit different
today.
We're
doing it smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe.
Yes. So our guest today is Walt Williams, a friend, also a writer and narrative designer who has worked on games you may have played, including Spec Ops The Line, Star Wars Battlefront 2. Walt, we're so happy to have you with us.
I am so happy to be here digitally outside of my house in some strange way.
Yes. In the ether. We're so glad to have you. It's interesting. When we started talking about this podcast, we knew that we were going to launch with our first couple of weeks talking about how different aspects of the are affected. And I looked at Amanda. I said, you know, and this is something that she had said to me before all this happened 4 years ago, that we were going to see a shift in narratives and the way people approach games, that we weren't going to see necessarily a diminishment of serious, ultra-realistic, violent games, but that there is going to be a bigger space carved out, even amongst hardcore gamers,
for cozy gaming,
right? That's the name, the label that's been applied to it.
I love it. Cozy gaming is my new favorite thing. Well, actually, it's not a new, always been my favorite thing. But yeah, I talked about that after the American election, because I'm Canadian, so I am living in America, watching on in horror, as I often do. So that was my commentary from 4 years ago when Mike and I were drinking over Skype.
So
let me tell you that was the day before my birthday.
And
it was wonderful. Oh, such a wonderful birthday the next day.
Oh, how bad of a hangover did you?
Well, we just had a baby too, so I think.
Oh, you had a baby hangover.
Oh,
yeah. It was all.
Oh, so you were just walking around in a stupor. It wasn't until 3 months later that you woke up and you're like, "Wait, what?"
Oh, no, absolutely. Like the next day, family came, wished me happy birthday, and gave me presents. Family who I knew had voted for the winner, and they just immediately started launching into how everything was going to change. And I just remember like looking them in the eye and like jabbing a finger at them, and going, "I don't want it."
Yeah,
it's my birthday.
Oh,
please know.
There was the Thanksgiving that happened right after that. My dad and I almost, and that's a longer story for over this one. We're allowed to be in actual physical presence, or we'll just do a Skype call. But back to the point of cozy gaming, which you can also play with a beer in hand.
We have done this often.
But I gotta tell you, as far as like the ultra violent, like, gore fests, Doom Eternal had an amazing launch. They sent Bethesda sent out a press release, but Animal Crossing, which came out the exact same day, and boy, there was that amazing synergy between those two games.
Doom Crossing, you mean?
Doom Crossing. Animal Crossing has done exceptionally well. Now, we don't have the numbers everywhere yet, but the numbers came out of Japan today.
They did.
For retail from Famitsu.
Ooh, those are some big numbers.
Yeah, why don't you walk us through it?
All right, so the first biggie, this is the biggie for me. It's not even necessarily the retail of games. I'll let you talk about the retail mm-hmm. aspect for the games. What I want to talk about is how many Switches were sold.
How many Switches?
Okay, so 392,000 Switches were sold between Classic and Light last week alone.
Okay, and why is that number?
Because the launch of the Nintendo Switch was 330,000.
So they've sold more Switches last week, probably because, I think it's safe to say, because of Animal Crossing.
And the very special edition Animal Crossing Switch,
yes,
which we have in our house,
yes,
because I am also a sucker.
I don't know.
It's really nice.
It also got you the Animal Crossing Switch in the game.
It was worth it.
I mean,
would have been like tens of thousands.
Most expensive DLC anybody's ever purchased.
So
what
that's probably not true. You're the first person I've spoken to who has one, and I'm going to assume you already had a Switch. Can you, because I and I'm not being critical, I genuinely want to know, what is it about one of these customized switches that makes you want to buy a second piece of hardware you already have?
All right.
Oh,
so,
no.
Okay.
We have to walk through this.
All right. So as many of our friends know, but not everybody knows, we're poly. So there are four adults in that.
Okay.
And there are also four children.
There are also four children in that, which means our ratio is still one save. Now, there were already three switches in the house. Because yeah. We purchased, so at launch, I need to be honest with you, how many did I have?
That's so many. We took one.
You and I shared one, and James had one.
Yes.
Right? So I had six other switches that I sold at cost to friends that couldn't get one. Like, I pre-ordered, like, from Best Buy and Target and from Walmart and from Amazon. And they, assuming they weren't all going to show up, and they all showed up. So, but I knew this well enough in advance that I said, hey guys, I have extra switches. So if you know me, you know, and you want one,
We'll bring it to Boston.
We brought two to Boston. I gave one to Slewinski and I gave one to Brian Roundy. And there were people around here that we gave the rest to. So we kept two of them. Again, we didn't sell them at a profit. We sold them at cost because we just wanted to get them into people's hands. And so what's been happening though was Danielle, our partner, was playing Murder by Numbers on my Switch. So I didn't have a Switch for a while. So
she got real addicted.
She loves Picross.
Yeah, a lot.
So what happened was when this popped up, like, hey, Amanda, one of our friends was able to get this one for Amanda. It was like, okay, well, we were thinking the Mythical Switch Pro was going to come out.
Yeah,
okay. And we were going to be replacing, like, but that didn't happen. So what we ended up doing was taking Amanda's old Switch and designating it the family Switch. So the kids can play on it. And we actually made that Switch the primary for all three of the adults that have libraries right now. So Switch is like the magic Switch because it can play every game that three adults own. And the kids can have access to that. And Danielle's on it. And Grace, who's our eldest, started playing Animal Crossing.
Vivian has been wanting to play Animal Crossing. Viv, she's our youngest.
So for us, the calculus wasn't hard because we have two PlayStation 4s, two PlayStation 4 Pros. We have an OG Xbox, an Xbox One S. We've got
Why
two
are
Xbox
you showing our
X's
hand like this?
Because there are a lot of
What are you
kids.
Doing?
Well, I mean, it's just, it just so happens that we have a lot of people who play games in this house.
Yeah,
so
it's like almost everyone in the family plays games. Like, Danielle and Grace are our outliers. Like, they play some games, but it's not very often. But, like, all the little kids play a ton of games. And the three of four of the adults play a ton of games, and two of four of the adults are game journalists.
I mean
honestly, like, for a household of eight people, like, the number of consoles that you're naming right now actually seems totally appropriate.
Well, and we have our guest bedroom upstairs has a TV in it, and there's a Switch dock in there, and like, you can hook up a PlayStation in there, so it is like an alt, because we make very good use of the space in there.
We do. For all eight of us.
Yeah, for all eight of us. It is hard sometimes to find a quiet space. So having that second bedroom, our office is actually the quietest. But I think your question is a good one. Like,
no,
if you have a Switch
valid.
And you live alone, right? Or you have a partner, if you it's you and your partner and your partner doesn't play games, why would you buy a second Switch?
Exactly.
I think you're right. I mean,
I don't think I would have purchased the Animal Crossing Switch if I hadn't already intended on purchasing an additional Switch for the family so that the kids could use it and so they could stop bothering me to play Adventure Pals on my Switch all the time.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, listen, I'm in the middle of Ni No Kuni. What are you doing? Stop taking my Switch. You guys gotta knock it off. So we had already determined that that was something we wanted to do for the little ones anyway. And having, like, Danielle being able to play her game has been a real boon for her.
And we are trying to get her hooked on Animal.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think that she might poo-poo that. Aww. I think she'd get bored. Maybe. It's too cozy for her. I think she just wants
my numbers. But you said, you know, before the show, you mentioned you've been playing Animal Crossing.
I have.
How much Animal Crossing have you played?
Well, I've played it since the day that it came out. So what are we at? Three now?
Hold on. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Right.
We're on day six, if you played every day.
Oh my God, is that what today is? Okay, you're right. It's Wednesday.
It's been one big long day. It's okay.
Yes, I've been playing since it came out on Friday. Now I have a very busy personal life at the moment, strangely enough. Won't necessarily go into all that right now, but I basically have had to quarantine my Animal Crossing time to the 1 to 2 hours in the morning before my child gets up. And then maybe 30, 45 minutes in the middle of the day if I can get in there. And then an hour or two at night before I pass out. So I'm playing probably more on the intended timetable versus the current we're all locked in our houses, fearing for our lives timetable.
I have played a number of Animal Crossing games and never have I gotten to the point where I've paid off my loan in the first.
I don't want to talk to you about that because I haven't had time because I am homeschooling the children.
I so went to Tarantula Island.
I've never played before. This is a first for me. So I got very excited about paying off that first and immediately realized it was a trap.
It was 100%. It's a raccoon trap. Yeah. You sprang Nook's trap card.
Yeah.
100%. This is my first really serious Animal Crossing game. Like, I didn't really think Animal Crossing was for me. And then I met Mike, and Mike's like, oh, hey, here's this cozy game you've never played before. I hear you like cute games. Here, play this cute game. And I'm like, oh, this could be my life. Oh.
So I like farm games. And that's And because I'd been playing pretty much exclusively. Actually, I think the only other game I played this year is Stardew Valley.
That's fair.
And it is a game that I had put away for about a year and a half. If it's even been out that long. Time has lost meaning.
It has.
But I recently re-downloaded it. I was like, oh, this will be fun. And played it for what I thought was an hour or so. And it turned out I'd lost an entire day. Stardew Valley, in a lot of ways, is heroin for me. In that as soon as I start playing, I just immediately wake up, you know, 8 to 10 hours later, you know, in a bathroom.
And you've lost time.
I don't know how I got there. I don't know who this person next to me is. But I do know that I have somehow managed to get a bunch of apples.
Now, my question is to say, hey... Hey, you're awake now.
So when this was coming out, I was like, I'm going to try and switch over to this. I hear this is also very similar. And it came out and I immediately jumped right into it. I've been enjoying it quite a lot. I'm having to adjust to the real world timetable. Mm-hmm. The real time day and night cycles is very because I've been I'll go through a whole year in Stardew Valley in a day if I think I can make a few million dollars out of that and I've got nothing else to do, or if I have other things to do and I'm just choosing to ignore my family, which, you know, happens easily with that game.
That's me.
Animal Crossing is here's my quick capsule review of this game so far. It's extremely cute. It's very addictive. I don't like the fact that as soon as you open up a store, it's like, we're going to operate on actual business hours. Sorry if you have shit to do today. And so it's like...
Yeah, that's the thing I don't care for either.
Well, and that's the thing is, and then you have to make the decision, do I want to empty out my inventory into the box? And like, for some reason, they charge a fee for using their deposit box outside the store.
It's relatively small, but it's still frustrating. Like, I don't want to be charged for this.
Absolutely. And also, I'm a shut-in by nature. I've never been diagnosed as agoraphobic, but I'm sure if I broke it down with my therapist, she'd be like, yeah, a little bit. So Stardew Valley is a game where I ignore my family to pretend to be a farmer who ignores his friends and family in his digital world as well. And just focuses on, you know, cultivating fruit.
As one does.
As one does. And then I get into Animal Crossing. And suddenly, there are these other people on my island. And not only do they want to talk to me, they literally chase me down to talk to me on the island. They run after me shouting, hey, Walt, hey, Walt. Which both is terrible for me on a normal circumstance. But I don't know if it's, like, triggering anything in y'all right now. Where just it's like, why are you running up?
Stupid
to me?
Camouflaged Stop. Alligator, keep like, 6 feet away from me.
Practice social distancing.
It's hitting me on a bunch of emotional levels that I was not entirely prepared for what I thought was going to be a very slow, contemplative fish and grow fruit game. So that's fun.
And then, of course, there's the whole aspect where to get the most out of the game, like, you only start with one type of fruit, right?
Yeah.
So in order to get the other five types, you have to either go to other people's islands or have them come.
It is the networking has been so tricky. There's so many different steps just to make it go that I've done it a couple times. And it's just, I think I'm.
It's cumbersome. It's cumbersome. It is. Like, the Nintendo Online stuff has always been really cumbersome. I don't know what the heck they were thinking with creating new instances for every time. That's what it feels like, is that they're creating new instances of your island every single time someone comes to visit. Like, they're like, oh, there's a new person coming. We're going to create a new instance of your island. And that's what that's feeling like. And that's the reason that's from my perspective anyway. That's what's going on when they're like, oh, don't do anything while this person's flying in. No, they're creating a new instance of your island. Mm-hmm. In that, because
they create a save point every.
Yeah. And, you know, so, and I actually didn't realize that was happening. And that makes a lot of sense now, because the first time someone came to visit me, like a sap, I went inside my airport and stood at the gate waiting for them to walk in to be like, hey, you came. And then they're like, hey, dude, where are you? I'm at your house. And I'm like, oh.
Aww.
You gotta wait for them outside your air. Yeah, it's
I didn't know that. And I'm just standing at the gate at my airport like a sad dad.
Were you holding a sign up?
Oh, yeah, like, it was just the whole thing. And it's just like, oh, well, this is okay. I guess it's just a game. I'll go find you.
Oh,
here's some apples. Thanks for coming by. Of course, none of this can be said because typing with your Switch controller is terrible.
Ah, here's a secret. If you connect it to your Nintendo Online app on your phone, you can actually text on your phone and have it appear in the game.
Yeah, so I tried to download that, and I guess it was the day that everyone realized you could do that.
Oh.
The download of the app was... after like 3 minutes of downloading, it was like 15% done. I was like,
ain't nobody got time for that.
Yeah, I'll give it another couple of weeks and see if the download speeds speed up quicker. But it's like,
fair.
I mean, I've never played Animal Crossing before. I am really enjoying it. I've kind of hit that point where I'm like, I see what this game is. I see behind the curtain now, as like someone who works in video games, or like I can see what the experience is going to be for probably the next 100 hours if I keep playing. And it scratches just enough of an itch where, and since I'm not playing it non-stop all day like I would with Stardew Valley, I can kind of see continuing on with it for a while. Mm-hmm. But I definitely woke up this morning, I was like, well, I could get on and I could check my fruit and do stuff, or I could read 50 pages of a book. Let's find somewhere in the middle. I'll do 40 pages and jump on my it's already kind of starting to activity, mainly because I just can't push it up. I cannot push that button to get my fix nonstop constantly like I can with a Stardew Valley. So we'll see if I adjust to it. I mean, it's not like I mean, I do have other stuff to do, but it's not like I have other stuff to do. So, you know how it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about this game is that once it settles into its rhythm, you play for maybe half an hour a day and you get everything that... But here's the interesting thing. We're not the only ones playing Animal Crossing.
Are you sure?
I'm sure. We don't have the numbers yet, right? We don't
for
worldwide.
There are no numbers.
But you talked
worldwide.
About the Switch sales,
I
right?
I did, yeah.
But we actually have software sales for Japan. Famitsu's reporting that 1.88 million copies. With digital on top of that, we've heard it's 2.5 million. 2.5 million units in Japan alone in the game's first. So when those worldwide numbers come out, it's going to be big. I mean,
that's going to be colossal.
We are talking Pokemon level numbers that this game is putting up. And that's not common for an Animal Crossing game.
No, definitely not. Man, can you imagine the attach rate on this?
Like, oh,
calculating that attach rate.
I have a funny feeling that we're going to see some big, 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 big stuff.
You know, I really think that it did hit at that perfect time. And I hesitate to use that word, but like, I did pick it up knowing what we were getting into with the lockdown and the shutdowns all across the country and everything. Like, this would be kind of perfect. And I know a lot of my friends around here who know that I work in games, because I live in a kind of a semi-rural town in North Louisiana where I'm separate from my video game industry friends and jobs. So most of the people around here are not plugged into the industry like we are. So, but they'll come to me and they'll be like, hey, what have you heard about this game? What have you heard about this game? And I've had so many people ask me, what do you know about this Animal Crossing thing? Because they are all hearing it for the same reason. You're seeing people online talk about it, how this is going to be the perfect game for being stuck in your household. Yep. And that, I think that is, people who don't even really know what it is, that's resonating with them. And they're saying, you know, they may already have a Switch in the house, or they're like, well, I mean, a Switch would kind of be perfect right now for what we're doing. And people are saying this game. And like, as far as like just kind of being that perfect cultural moment, it really did land exactly where it needed to be, which is wild.
And I think that that's a good segue into what it is, you know, the main reason. Yeah, no,
it's true.
You know, obviously we talk about these cultural moments. We talk about how games fit into our lives, and games in fact also respond to our lives. I want to talk a little bit about narrative in general, but I want to ask you first, can you give us a little bit of background on your experience in the industry? We said when we introduced you that you wrote Spec Ops The Line, you wrote Star Wars Battlefront 2. Tell us a little bit more about kind of how you got into the industry and the projects you've worked
on. Yeah, I mean, so I got into the industry. I moved up to New York City about a year after thinking I would get into maybe a writing career. Looking to pursue writing, thinking about maybe getting into comic books, Marvel and DC. Hadn't become, you know, big film studios as well at the time. They were still focused in their comic headquarters in New York. And I'd always, you know, grew up reading comics. And so I moved up there with my significant other at the time, who was going up there for college. And trying to just, you know, figure out what I was going to do with my post-college life, where I really didn't, I'd never thought, hey, I'm going to move to New York. That had never been part of the plan. But I ended up meeting some people that I had some loose connections with at a bar, one of whom happened to be Stuart Thompson, who was a hiring manager of Take-Two Interactive. And he was telling me how they had just that Take-Two is a big umbrella publisher. They own Rockstar Games, which everyone knows. But they had just recently opened up this new publishing branch, which was 2K. And he was like, hey, you know, we're really staffing right now. They're looking for some entry level positions. Why don't you send your resume over to me? So I went in, interviewed with them, and it was for this position called a game analyst, which was really kind of, it's like a creative production assistant is kind of probably what you would hear at other companies. Game analyst, I think they changed the name because everyone thought, oh, you're just QA. And they're like, no, it's not QA. It was working with the developers, working with producers, getting into the nitty gritty of the games and like kind of being a creative, resource for everyone on the publishing and the dev side across a bunch of different and there, you know, I got the job offer. I was like, hey, this would be a great thing to do until my writing career takes off. And then they were like, oh wait, we've got this guy now on staff who we're paying entry-level salary, who knows narrative and writing. We should go ahead and start plugging him into this stuff because that's going to be a lot cheaper.
Big industry mood.
Hey, it worked out well. And so I did, you know, I learned because I'd never intended to move to New York. I never intended to get in the video game. And suddenly I was doing both and loving both. I loved working the people I was working with at 2K. I loved working with developers, working on multiple different projects because I was on the publishing side mostly, but getting to like go and like live on site with developers and work on site with them, sync with them over long periods of time and like really get the games. Learn aspects of design and narrative. And, you know, working over time, you know, built my way up to being, went from a game analyst to associate producer. And then people realized Walt would be a terrible producer. We really don't need to let him produce anything. He has a creative mindset, not a mindset of let us organize things. And so let's push him into narrative. And I went story editor and then writer and writer and senior writer, blah, blah, blah. And just kind of went off from there. Once I really got into working with Spec Ops, the writing stuff really kind of took off. And when I left 2K and went freelance, then began working on other projects with other studios, which led to me getting to do work on with Lucasfilm and EA on their Star Wars games. You know, I've worked on some other projects that haven't actually been announced yet, that should be hopefully announcing soon. Who knows anymore? But also, you know, I've worked on the BioShock franchise, Borderlands, The Mafia, Darkness, Civilization, pretty much anything 2K published from 2005 to 2014, 15? Yeah, I think it was 14 when I left. Just kind of trying to, you know, work on everything I possibly can. Spec Ops is the thing I'm most known for sure. But yeah, Star Wars was fun too. That's a thing. It's a small little franchise, you know. Some people
tiny.
Heard of,
but you were, now, quick question about Star Wars Battlefront.
Yeah.
I know you worked with Mitch Dyer on that.
Yes.
So did you create Iden? Is Iden Versio your creation?
We did. Yeah. And just, I generally don't talk too much about the Star Wars stuff because it can always be tricky going into that. But yeah, Mitch and I created Iden Versio and Inferno Squad. That was all us. And then if there's a character, you know, we did a lot of work to try and make sure that it connected to films and all the other different transmedia stuff like comics and books. We really enjoyed that aspect of it, of like reading all of the new canon, like seeing. In a lot of ways, it felt like looking at encyclopedias of like an actual period of time and seeing like how all these different events in other stories would be lining up and possibly connecting this nexus of our story. And that was really fun. That's something that I've always really liked about video game narrative design and video game writing, is that in a lot of projects you get brought in later and you're taking all of these disparate pieces that different departments have created without not necessarily syncing up and having to find that point where they actually, if you would draw a line where they would all go next, okay, now how would these things logically overlap to make it seem like we really planned this from the beginning? And that's fun. It's like, for me, it's like a puzzle. Just working with pieces that don't want to go together, and so you have to like hammer them into position until it's like, yes, that definitely looks like a picture on a box. It's not for everyone, but you know, some of us masochists, you know, we enjoy it.
That, you know what, that's fair. That is absolutely fair. That's a good segue into another question that we have. I've always been curious because when I was getting out of university, I was being courted to work at places like EA, because I'm from British Columbia, so I moved down to Vancouver when I was done with university. And so I moved down there and I went and I did some interviews and stuff like that. And I was planning on entering into the game industry, but my background's in development, so they wanted to go and push me into tools development and everything like that. And I'm like, well, what can I do to like work the writing stuff? So from my perspective, I would love to know a bit more about how writers tend to work within the larger game development team, especially on AAA games.
Well, honestly, so it's different with every project and every studio, because every studio and every creative director and every producer has a different view of what writing, and it kind of depends. I found in my experience that it depends on the core philosophy of the creative director and what path they've taken to that point in their career. If they're more design focused, if they've come up as a designer, they can see the importance of story, they can see the importance of narrative, and they can respect it, but they're always going to see it as something that's secondary to design. That a lot of times story exists to contextualize, create a logic so that the illogical makes sense. Because a lot of times design can be illogical, because it's more about what does someone think is going to just be cool to happen? Okay, well, that's cool, but why does it happen? Well, that's not our job. We came up with the coolness. You have to explain why it's cool.
So you have to connect the set pieces.
Yes.
Exactly. Connect the set pieces. Explain why, you know, this explosion to this explosion. Go. Also, you have 45 seconds of cinematics that you can spread around the entire game, which we're expecting to be about 20 hours long, and no animation whatsoever. You can't have faces. Faces are bad. So go.
Faces are bad. Go. That is entirely the world right now. Faces are bad.
Faces
go.
Are bad.
Faces are bad. Go back inside.
See, this is what you see, video game writers. We were prepared for this. This has been our whole life. But you know, then you have other creative director. If they identify, you will see a lot more of the narrative, the design feeding into the narrative, vice versa. And really, ultimately, like what you want it to be, the ideal final product is something where it feels like both the narrative is informing the design in the moment emotionally, and then the narrative is growing out of what happens in the design that the player is then doing. Because you want that's ultimately, you want there to be a, you know, it's about finding a team where everyone's collaborating, everyone's communicating. And, you know, every studio is different. Every studio has a different structure. Every person that you meet, it doesn't matter what the job you're doing, not everyone is going to want to listen to everyone else's opinion or collaborate or incorporate other people's ideas.
That's right.
But you know, when you're writing, sometimes you just have to go up to a designer and go, yes, look, the idea that you have for this level is really great. It's exciting. It's high octane. But the main character literally just had their parents killed in front of them, and this is supposed to be a sad moment. So maybe Gods of the not it now.
That's
is there yeah. And they'll be like, yeah, but I don't know. Maybe the machine guns are the metaphor. Just make it work. And you go, yeah, sure. Whatever.
Okay, machine gun metaphor it is.
All right. I feel like we might have just landed on a title for this episode. Machine guns are the metaphor.
Machine oh my God, guns it's are brilliant. Always the metaphor.
It's brilliant.
I love it. I
love the way your brain works.
I want to shift gears. I mean, you mentioned that Spec Ops is the game that people most associate with you. And I think there's... I mean, that's a great thing. You know, Spec Ops: The Line. You walk into that game, Amanda. You haven't played
it? I have not.
I feel like we should sit down and play it. So I'm not going to spoil it because this is a game that I don't want to be spoiled for anybody who hasn't played it. Like,
well,
go...
considering you and I have been talking about this game off and on since basically the moment we first got together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
so,
time.
So for those who don't know, Spec Ops: The Line, it subverts a lot of expectations in a military. Nolan was the lead in that.
Yes, he was. He was the lead. And we started working with the Spec Ops had a long development. So when we started working with Nolan, only Uncharted 1 was. That's the point in Nolan's career where we were working with him. And I remember Uncharted 2. Coming out in maybe like the first or second year of production and be like, dude, hey man, people are really digging this Nathan Drake guy you got going on. You know, not knowing that, you know, how much Nolan was then going to explode even more across the entire industry. I mean, Nolan is a gift to work with. I mean, the reason Nolan, one, he's an extremely talented voice actor, but he's a genuine pleasure to work with. You enjoy spending time with him. You enjoy collaborating with him. Everything about working with Nolan, from start to finish.
You know,
fantastic.
You love to hear that because a lot of times it's like, don't meet your heroes, don't meet your idols. And then every once in a while, someone like Nolan.
For me, I spent about 5 years working on that game. And I went from being relatively new in the industry to being pretty seasoned by the end. And so for someone who was learning to direct actors over the course of those 5 years, I could not have asked for a better lead to have over the course of that process for me than Nolan.
And thankfully, you know, Walker is a wildly different character than Nate. You know, just to set the stage for those who haven't played the game, it takes place in Dubai. Dubai's been ravaged by sandstorms. You are Special Forces? Walkers and
you
Captain?
Are Delta Squad.
Delta Squad.
Which, I think technically this is, yeah. Army Special Forces. You are, yes, you're a three-man Delta Squad that is sent into Dubai to search for survivors after the city has been ravaged and cut off by a major natural disaster. Specifically, Colonel John Conrad, an American war hero, a large-scale evacuation attempt, and was considered lost and dead, along with all of the people he went in to get out of the city. and someone that your main character, Captain Walker, a brief past with. You served together in another conflict in another part of the world, a different time in your life, and he saved your life. So you have this connection, albeit a brief one, and you go in trying to find him and discover that not only a lot of people are still alive, Dubai has descended into some kind of militaristic anarchy where the normal citizens of Dubai are in revolt against Conrad's battalion, who have placed the city under a very brutal martial law in order to try and keep everyone alive, and are now in the grips of a war.
And without going too far into it, I mean, there's so much in there. There's some pieces of that story that start to feel familiar if you know literature or you know, classic film.
Yes, absolutely.
But you did such an amazing job subverting every expectation that I think people had walking into a game. In, you know, this game is a game that came out in Call of Duty's like big heyday, and people, you know, were like, oh, it's a military game, and then you play it, and again, not wanting to spoil this, it takes such a hard left turn, and the reveal in that game is just miraculous. It is one of my favorite games, at least of last generation, if not of all time.
Oh, thank you. Largely because,
well, it's the truth. I talk about it all the time because the story is so good.
He's been trying to sell me on this game, and I've already been sold on it. It's just like, where's the time? Where's the time to sit down and play?
For what it's worth, it's pretty short. It'll take you about 6 hours.
Yeah, it's not that long. We should just spend a weekend, sit down with the kids. I'm kidding. I'm kidding. And when we play it, you will reflect on me saying that, and you will, like... So
I do have a rubber fish that I'm going to write your name on.
But one of the things that's really wonderful about that game is its handling of very complex, heavy mental health issues. And you know, I want your perspective on this. How do you think, you know, knowing what you know about tackling challenging issues and relatable challenging in video games, how do you think that people in the industry are going to react to our current situation when it comes to games?
And I'm obviously I knew coming into this talk with y'all that was going to be the question, but that is a question.
It is a big one.
I've thought about it a lot, all, and there's, so you have a few different, and I think the weirdest thing is when you think about like what kind of narratives are going to come out of it. The most literal, obvious narrative that could come out of this in a video game actually came out last year, and we laughed at him. We laughed at Kojima. We said, what is this weird stuff he's doing?
Yeah.
He has completely gone off the deep end. And now we are just all stuck in our homes, trying not to be killed by some weird virus ghost thing, while the true heroes are the men and women running around delivering us food in our little sheltered... It's wild.
Well, the funny
thing was... upsetting. And this was a conversation that Mike and I had... Just not even days ago. It must have been yesterday that we had this conversation about Death Stranding and Metal Gear Solid. What was it?
Metal Gear Solid 2.
Yeah.
And, you know, the funny thing was when Death Stranding came out and we started to learn what that game actually was, I jokingly said, you wait. Because
this
it
is
took
prophetic.
Metal Gear Solid 2 came out in, I mean, it came out like, what? It was 20. It was that game kind of became reality. With memes and overloading information, and therefore somebody, like, the message being controlled in such a way. And I said, I am really eager to see how Kojima's vision in Death Stranding comes true. And I wish I could go back in time and slap myself across the face.
Because I'm gonna get that fish.
A, I didn't think it was gonna happen so soon, and B, this is definitely not the way I thought it was gonna happen. But he has this weird prophetic ability. And it's scary.
It's a little scary.
He's got to be CIA, right? Like, he's got to be, like, an asset to some shadowy... I mean, just look at...
I'm just really glad that he didn't work on Silent Hill. Because, like, yike. Can we talk about that for a second? Because so many buckets of yikes. I don't want that prophecy fulfilled. Thank you very much.
Seriously.
Do not
want it. I don't even...
I don't like it.
It is so weird, though, for that Death Stranding, you know, his time to reality, like Kojima's time from from launch to reality has gotten significantly shorter.
Months.
I'll say this.
Literal
I think
months.
We are blessed that that game came out. Because let's be honest, video games, when it comes to trying to tap to what's happening immediately in the world, we can be very literal.
Yeah.
Creative. And now we can't do that because it just looks like you're ripping off Death Stranding. Now we're going to have to actually get creative with our COVID-19 metaphors and come up with something different. So he's done something wonderful for the industry by totally lapping all of us like 5 times.
And so, you know, to build on that a little bit more, what kinds of stories and what kinds of, you know, machine gun metaphors are we thinking that we're going to be building over the next handful of years as a result of our experience?
So I think there's two ways that it can go. And the first is it's not uncreative, but it's and I say that it's easy because it's what we've already been experiencing in games for really a lot of the history of the medium, which is isolation. Some games do it more artfully. If you take a game like Shadow of the Colossus that has a true, genuine sense of isolation and sadness and loss. And then other games that are just feel isolated because it's really hard to create a big populated world that feels real. And so we make a lot of games where just coming into a city or a place that has been completely ravaged by some terrible thing in there, except some people who might show up to kill you. But you can just look around in the remains of this isolated place and discover what happened, because that's just easier.
Mm-hmm.
We can make an empty ruined place for me feel more realistic than a living, bustling modern city. So isolation is something we do very good because of the technical limitations. However, I think what I would hope, I'm not going to say this is a prediction. This is what I would hope we're going to see out of it, because we're very good at isolation. We're also very good at making you feel bad, because I will put myself number one on the list of being super guilty of this. But it's easy to make someone feel bad in a video game. It's easy to manipulate your emotions negatively, to feel sadness, to feel fear, to feel anger. We can make you depressed much easier than we can make you feel hopeful, than we can make you feel connected, than we can make you feel happy. And I'm using happy instead of something like joyful, because it's easy to make you feel joy and excitement.
Yes.
We can get your adrenaline, but we cannot fill you easily with a feeling of contentment that all is right with the world. And a lot of that comes from the fact that most of our AAA game mechanics are a negative reactions. It is an act of coming to an obstacle and removing it by force so that you can continue. That is, you know, it's a negative effect that you're having on the world. You are taking an obstacle out in order to continue your personal progress. And with AAA games, that obstacle is often, you know, contextualized as a living. So it gets tricky to create hopeful contentment around, hey, you see that guy in front of me? He's dead now, but it was for a good reason. That one's rough. We're dealing with that a lot right now. So hopefully what I would want of this, and I'm hoping because Kojima has already given us the very literal narrative video game experience around this, that we're going to see games that grow out of that sense of isolation and strive to create that sense of hope, that playing these games and the stories and the narratives that come out of this that make you begin to feel hopeful about the world around you and the experience that you're going through, and hopeful about the experience that you're in right now in your actual physical. And to an extent, there's something of that in Animal Crossing.
Full circle.
It's a very,
we've come full circle.
You did it.
But you know, I would, you know, Animal, it's a welcoming world. The characters there, they want you to be there, just so they can bilk you with loan after loan. Tom Nook, you know, but he's still happy that you're. He genuinely wants you to be there to give you, to give him your shells. But the other island people, you know, they're happy to meet you. Except for tarantulas, generally pretty cool.
Except for wasps
don't like you either.
Oh yeah, the wasps. Oh jeez, I hate those wasps.
I hate them so much. They make me so angry.
But you know, with Animal Crossing, there's really much a narrative to it other than simply what the gameplay is. The gameplay is the narrative,
yeah,
in a lot of ways in Animal Crossing. So finding to stories that allow to start from a place of emptiness and start from a place of isolation that build to something hopeful, even if it still remains in isolation. Let's be honest, we're going to see a lot of this come out of the indie.
Oh, absolutely. Sure.
The indie space is where video games truly innovate with narrative.
Yep, agreed. I've been saying that for years, absolutely.
Yeah, and if they do it well enough, then they get something and go off and make, you know, a Half-Life game. Which is great. That means, because that's what I was always hoping, is that the indie space was going to kind of work as an R&D for AAA, where AAA would go, oh, hey, that thing over there was actually really cool. We could probably scale that up and do something similar like that in a different type of game. And it didn't totally work out that way. It's just those people went from like bigger studios to making smaller studios, proving that they knew what they were talking about, and then getting them to go and do bigger things. And hey, whatever works, whatever gets us there. So hopefully, you know, with having this kind of a more thoughtful approach to narrative that kind of grows out of, in some spaces, the indie movement, but then the indie movement feeding back into the AAA movement, I personally hope that we're going to begin to see games that, you know, that maybe start in that darker place that kind of echoes the darker place that we're all in right now, and that isolation and that fear and that doubt, and then grows into a narrative or an experience that at the end makes you feel hopeful about not just the game experience, not just the character that you're playing, but the world that you are physically existing in and interacting in once you put that controller down. Because I think where we're at right now that's so interesting is that we can see the end. We know that statistically this will end eventually. There will be an end to what we're going through. But I don't think that there is any sense that there is a true light at the end of the tunnel. Even though this may end, there's no sense that that end is going to lead to, we don't know where we're going to be. We don't know if it's going to be a better situation. There's no sense of that will definitely be the day where everything is fine. And if we could begin to create video game narratives, particularly AAA narratives, that can give us a glimpse of what a possible better future is, a better way of life, a better way of interacting with the world. God, wouldn't that be such a great gift?
Man, I love that.
That's a chef's kiss.
That is probably the most.
I just hope we.
I hope we get there too. Genuinely, I hope that we don't do the on the nose thing where it's isolation in hand with desolation.
We'll leave that to Ubisoft in the. Okay.
Well, I mean, I expect we're gonna get a lot of zombie games.
Hmm.
Because if there's anything that's more of a metaphor than the machine gun, it's zombie.
zombie is a metaphor.
Really, the only metaphor a zombie truly is in video games is, what if the AI just doesn't have to think and it just runs at you?
Ooh, we learned something tonight, Mike.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, he says.
Oh, no. You pulled back the curtain.
Oh, no, we didn't want to see that behind that curtain. No, I'm just kidding.
That was in no way a subtweet or any kind of shade at programmers or AI programmers or anything like that. Just personal feelings on, like I said earlier, isolation is easy, so are zombies.
And mic drop. Okay, Mike, who do we have on for an indie spotlight today?
Today's Indie Spotlight is Broken Arms Games. We have with us Elisa Farinetti, who is a co-founder at the studio and also responsible for business development. Broken Arms Games is working on a title called 100 Days, which was recently part of the Steam Game Festival, and is about winemaking in the studio's home country of Italy. Elisa, please tell us a little bit more about the studio.
The company was born in September 2013. We are a small development team of 5 persons. Located in the northwest part of Italy. We are currently working on 100 Days, a game about winemaking that involves balancing resources and managing time. We are creating this game because winemaking is part of our cultural heritage. We live in Piemonte, and this region is one of the most well-known wine area in Italy. Yves Holler, co-founder of the studio, has a degree in winemaking, and his family used to produce wine. The entire team is deeply connected with the cultural heritage of Piemonte, and this makes the experience depicted in the game a truly realistic simulation. 100 Days takes pride in offering the player a thorough experience. Real data provided from local winemaking businessmen have been used and implemented in the game, while even in the in-game tools and machinery are modeled after the real ones. We started working on the idea of this game during late summer 2018. We worked on it discontinually for more than a year and a half now. 100 Days will put you in charge of managing a small and abandoned winery, from selecting the type of vine you want to grow, to naming your final product. Every decision of the challenging business of winemaking will be in players' hands. Take care of your vineyards, learn to follow the rhythm of season, harvest, label your bottle, and sell them on the market. Every choice the player makes will have an impact on the quality and the quantity of the wine he produces and sell. We're planning to release the game on multiple platforms, but first PC, and then we will take it to iOS and Nintendo Switch.
Lisa, Italy was one of the first countries in the West to go into full lockdown as a result of COVID-19. It was really a marvel to watch, and of course we're experiencing some of that here in the United States and in other places throughout the world. I'm curious, how has that impacted the development of 100 Days? How has it changed your processes?
As a team, we already worked remotely. In our central office, we are usually in three. Our game designer, Francesco, my business partner, Eve, and myself. Since the lockdown started, we just kept going on our remote system, adding also Francesco to the ones working from home. So all our working pipeline didn't change too much. We already use cloud servers to store assets and data. Our repositories are all in cloud. And we chat all day through Discord and Slack to organize tasks and solve problems. So this was pretty much usual for us. The main issue that we found was especially with some of our clients. As we do work for hire, and those clients are big corporations, they are not used to remote working. So we had to slow down a little bit some process in order to give them time to adjust to the new reality. But actually, after a couple of weeks, we can say the situation is pretty normal.
I'm glad to hear that development is continuing and that you've found a rhythm even amidst all of this chaos. I'm curious, though, obviously development isn't the only thing affected by COVID-19. How are you finding a way to balance work and life under this new way of living?
Finding a balance between our self-care and job is not easy. Even I personally, we do yoga in the morning. We try to take some break, especially during the weekend, not caring much about the company and maybe cooking or play video games and what we love. But on the other side, we are worried about this whole situation. First of all, on the health side, and then on the business and economic side of it. We are trying to be as flexible as possible with the team as well, especially in terms of working time. This is not the moment to count minutes of work and being precise with that. As long as the work is done in time, it's fine for us.
Were you planning on attending GDC or E3 or any of the other shows that were canceled? Obviously, that's been a big impact on developers all over the world.
Yes, we were planning to attend GDC. Usually, we start prepping GDC and buy flights and tickets in late December, beginning of January, to get them for a lower price. 2018, last months of the year, have been quite rough in terms of finance for us, so we postponed those tasks and we were planning on buying them last minute. So as soon as we saw the worldwide situation being every day more critical, we got in contact with other Italian developers and friends to share ideas, and we all came up to the conclusion to wait. So we did it, and thanks to that we were able not to waste so much money on those events. We had a lot of plans for this 2020 GDC, as we were selected by Indie Megaboot, European Game Showcase, and we were nominated for the Game Connection Indie Development Awards. In-person meetings are crucial for this industry, and those kind of events are the only moment of the year where you can meet certain people. So that's quite hard to replace. But on the other side, all teams of the several events related to GDC literally work their heads off to guarantee to any of us many as much support as possible. Reimbursement and funding to cover dev losses, visibility opportunities coordinated with Steam, tweets and retweets, meeting organization and intros for anyone who needed help. I think that today more than ever, we felt part of the of a global community that really wants to support devs and their job. We had honestly the best example of a virtuous community ever.
One of the things that popped up in the wake of GDC's postponement was the Steam Game Festival, and 100 Days was part of that. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to be part of the Steam Game Festival and what results you might have seen from that initiative?
GDC postponement was definitely affected us somehow, but on the other side, the visibility that we've got during the Steam Game Festivals has been bigger than what we could have had in person at the conference. In less than 5 days, we doubled our wish list from 10,000 to 20,000. Our Discord server exploded with people interested to know more about the game. We got coverage from the press. The demo has been downloaded more than 25,000 times. We got the chance to validate the product even more, and we got time to work on the community. Having such a niche game, we needed to be sure the community around it is very strong and solid. And this lockdown situation gave us time to work on something a small team like us doesn't have too much resources to take care of. We spent the whole weekend last week chatting with people about aspects of the game. If we had to attend GDC instead, we would have spent the same weekend sleeping and getting back from jet lag, probably.
Alisa, how far along in development is 100 Days, and what are your greatest needs as a studio in order to move forward?
We are in a crucial moment of the development, as we have quite a stable alpha version, on which we have iterated for so long to solve most of the production problems, pipeline, assets, animations. We are close to a big production phase where we start to develop and assemble most of the content of the game. Thanks to Steam Game Festival, as I said before, we reached more than 20,000 wishlists, so we are growing the community as well. In order to progress to the next phase, we need to secure funding. Until now, we invested around 150,000 euros of our own, splitting the development of 100 days between other works, work for hire that we usually do, and putting all the profits of those projects into 100 days development, as we see a clear potential in this project. We are actively looking to have conversation with publishers and investments fund, as we think we have proven both the company capability to execute and its commitment, of course, as well as the potential of the project.
Alisa, where can people find Broken Arms Games and 100 Days online? You have a Steam page where people can wishlist the game, obviously, correct?
People can find us online on most platforms, on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our profile is simply the company name, so you search out for Broken Arms Games. 100 Days is on Steam, so remember to wishlist us, and you can even find the demo we released last week for both PC and Mac, free to download on itch.io from today. And if you're interested to know more about the game, please join our Discord server. It's definitely the best way to get in contact with my business partner, Eve, and myself, and to get to know the whole community.
Alrighty, that about wraps us up for episode six? Episode six.
I love that we have to look at that because we were so stupid. We've made a lot of dumb decisions in our life together. But this has got to be one of the peak dumb ideas.
Episode 6. Machine guns are metaphors.
Machine guns are metaphors. Machine guns are the metaphor. I Love it. Okay, but we need more indies to come hang out with us. Speaking of indies, you should come and hang out with us. Please. We need more indie games for our spotlight. You can get at us at @virtualeconcast. Our DMs are open. You can add us. You can email us, podcast@fsquared.biz. We really just want to share indie games. I mean, they can be indie games about zombies. They can be indie games about isolation. They can be indie games about being cozy and cute.
I think you just described Graveyard Keeper.
I love Graveyard Keeper. It's so good.
You did.
I know, right?
It's amazing.
Oh, it's so good. I didn't even mean to do it. Oh, I feel so good about myself right now. I'm going to give myself a high five after we're done.
So today, when you are all listening to this, it is Thursday. We have one more show this week.
We do.
So we did five last week.
Yes.
We did three this week.
Thank goodness.
I think we're going to settle into two next week.
I think we're going to settle on two. We're tired.
We already have one guest lined up.
Did we? Yes. Did we do it? Did we get the meme lord?
Yeah, Dave Oshry's going to be with us next week.
Yeah!
So that's going to be a lot of fun. That will probably be an explicit podcast.
Oh, that's 100% going to be our second explicit podcast.
Yeah. I'm just going to guess. But we do have a show tomorrow, Friday. We're going to have with us Eva Carr, the founder of Hey Glitch.
Eva's great.
Yeah.
I hung out with Hey Eva at the Game Developers of Color.
Hey Eva?
Hey Eva.
Hey Eva.
Hey Eva. Why are you doing this? Stop it.
It's all
hey
right.
there, Delilah. No. Hey there. We're not doing it. Stop it. We have to sign off.
I know. Let's sign off then. Thank you so much for listening to episode 6 of the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at @VirtualEconcast. I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I'm at Amanda Farrow, and no, I'm not spelling it.
You don't have to. I do. I just do. Walt, where can people find you on?
You can find me on Twitter at Walt D. Williams.
And you can subscribe to the virtual, our RSS feed is virtualeconomy.libsyn.com/RSS. You can also listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. If you are listening to us somewhere that allows you to review the show, please do that if you have nice things. If you do not have nice things to say, my personal DMs are open. You can call me mean names. Just do it there.
Okay.
Instead.
Because he knows that I don't check his DMs because that would be weird. Also, the best way that you can help the show is by subscribing. That is how we show Spotify, Apple, Google, all of them that we're worth paying attention to. Subscriptions matter. So that's really cool. But you can also DM us with questions or send them to podcast@fsquared.biz. So those are questions for us personally. I don't know why you'd ask us questions. But if you wanted to ask our guests questions, specifically Eva Carr and the meme lord, Dave Oshry, for next week, definitely do that. These are going to be both completely different conversations, but they're both going to be really great.
Yeah. And we will be back tomorrow.
I guess.
Yes. In the meantime,
wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to each other.